Hello,
and welcome to Lights Up on the Dark, the podcast where we explore the hows, whys, ifs, whats and whens of what it means to represent the Holocaust on stage. This week, I am joined by two brilliant women. Firstly, the other half of the Lights Up duo is back. Alexandra Gellner is back from touring, so that voice is Alex.
And that voice is Samantha Michka, aka Dr. Sam. Hello.
And then just to confuse everybody, we have another American voice in the Zoom studio today. The minute we started this podcast, we knew we wanted her as a guest. So we are very, very happy to introduce the lovely Professor Lisa Peschel. Welcome, Lisa.
Hello. Hello, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for being here.
So Lisa is very, very posh sounding. Lisa is Professor of Theatre in the School of Arts and Creative Technologies at the University of York, here in the UK. And she's also made my life incredibly easy by having a really concise bio on the Uni of York website. So all I've had to do is adapt it to the third person. So 10 years after completing a bachelor's degree in English literature, Lisa returned to full-time study to pursue her interest in theatre. At the University of Texas, she researched theatrical performance in the World War II Jewish ghetto at Terezin, or in German, Theresienstadt, completing and staging a play about the cultural life of the ghetto for an MFA degree in playwriting. During Lisa's doctoral studies at the University of Minnesota, she spent several semesters in the Czech Republic interviewing Terezin survivors and searching for previously unpublished scripts. In 2008, her annotated volume of plays and cabarets from the ghetto was published in Czech and German. In 2009, she completed a PhD thesis on survivor testimony about theatrical performance in the ghetto. And in 2014, the volume of plays was published in English. And Lisa, I think that's how I actually first encountered you and your work, because I was but a lowly PhD student at the time, and somewhere in the midst of time, I think I saw that selections from the scripts were being staged. Was it by your students or by a group of students at the Bloomsbury Theatre in London?
Yes, students from the University of York, actually directed by a student as well.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now that we've whetted your appetites and before we launch straight into things, it's time for the disclaimers.
Number one, Alex, Lisa and I all work for outside organisations, but this podcast is entirely on us. We don't represent them in this capacity. We're not speaking for them. This is mine and Alex's labour of love. So if you don't like something you hear, please blame us.
Number two, the Holocaust is an incredibly dark subject, as we know. So because we work with it every day, we use humour as a coping mechanism. We are not mocking the Holocaust. We are not mocking victims or survivors. We in no way intend to be disrespectful. We do use dark humor at times. So please bear this in mind while listening.
And number three is our rule of engagement. Questions, episode suggestions, corrections, comments, let us know. You can find the contact details in the show notes. Although I would like to say it's a bit random. We've had a few people use the contact form to send their email addresses and not much else. I don't know if people think they're signing up for a newsletter or something, which is flattering. I'm
like
really
it.
Flattered.
I think
we are not newsletter level. We'd like to be. We're working on it. So if you do use the contact form, please make sure you include what you would like to say when you reach out.
All right, skippers, you can stop skipping now. We've done that. Oh, it's disclaimers corners. Sam, shall we?
Let's do it.
So as you can probably tell from Lisa's bio, the focus in this week's episode is performance in Theresienstadt, and we're looking at Lisa's published volume, Performing Captivity, Performing Escape, Cabarets and Plays from the Theresienstadt Ghetto.
So to set the scene, pun absolutely intended, Lisa, could you give us the historical background of the ghetto?
I would be happy to, because This ghetto is a very unusual site within the whole network of the Nazi ghettos and camps. I do want to say just one thing to the name first, that Terezin is the Czech language name and Theresienstadt is the German language name, but it's not because the Nazis named it Theresienstadt. It's because this ghetto was originally a fortress built in a bilingual area. So I pretty much use both interchangeably. And some of the cabaret artists, they just used whichever version rhymed the best. So I'll briefly go back to the 1700s, which is when it was built. It was built as a fortress complex, so they're actually separate areas, not directly connected with each other, but built in the 1780s as a fortress complex to defend Austrian territory from the Prussians to the north. So the Habsburg Empire defending itself from the German state to its north. So it's built out in the middle of nowhere in this border region. And the small fortress, one part of the complex, was, it looks very much like a military installation. The large fortress was more like for the families of the soldiers, for all, the bakers, saddle makers, all the people who supported the fortress for them to live in. So to this day, when you go into the large fortress, it really looks like a small town, except with gigantic fortress walls surrounding it. So now, fast forwarding to the 20th century, even after World War I, so when the Habsburg Empire was broken up and the new state of Czechoslovakia arose, Theresienstadt became a base for the Czech army. Until the Nazis took over, until the Nazi occupation in 1939. And in 1940, the small fortress was turned into a Gestapo prison. So, for the enemies of the Reich, communists, other kinds of dissidents. And then, starting in November 1941, Czech Jews began to be sent to the large fortress. So, the purpose of the ghetto changed over the course of the war. It actually served a lot of different functions for the Nazis, but one of the key things was as a transit camp, because Terezin wasn't set up as a death camp, even though thousands of people did die there of disease and malnutrition. But it wasn't set up as a death camp. It was set up as a transit camp, so the Nazis could get the Jews out of Central Europe and then send them on to the death camps and the slave labor camps. So, because of that function, there are two things that happened that enabled the cultural life to become so active. One is relatively livable conditions. Excuse me. And I have to emphasize livable in relation to some of the other ghettos and camps. So, certainly not easy conditions, but like that there was a healthcare system, that there the food was inadequate, but not at the starvation levels that it was in many other ghettos and camps. And especially because the Jewish leadership of the camp was trying to help the young people survive, theater artists who tended to be younger actually had enough energy to engage in cultural activities after a full day of work. The other thing that they did was the Nazis hid the destination of outgoing transports. Because when you look at the history of uprisings, it's always when people are desperate. It's always when people know this is the end. It's either rebel or die. And so they concealed the fact that these outgoing transports leaving the ghetto were going to some, as we now know, some of the worst death camps, some of the most threatening destinations. So before Treblinka, the vast majority went to Auschwitz. So that's the background against which the cultural life arose.
Just hearing you just recount the history and also the conditions, it sounds very similar to the way the culture was formed within Vesterborg, to try to keep the prisoners basically in a mindset of that they're relatively safe.
That they could possibly survive. This is a really interesting comparison because Westerbork is also a transit camp, but in that camp, the commandant played a really active role in the cultural life. And in Theresienstadt, it really arose completely on the prisoners' own initiative. Shall I
So,
elaborate?
yeah, I was going to say, tell us more about, because of that's why you're here. We want to hear about the we're kind of like, yeah, that's the history, but yeah, let's because the cultural life at Terezin slash Trazians. I mean, I also side note, I never really knew that about the name. I thought it was in the same way that Łódź became Lichtenstadt, because that's what the Nazis called it. And so actually to get that historical clarification of no, it's because it was a bilingual area. So I learned something new today. Tell us more about that, about the cultural life.
The historical background is really important here as well, because for the first 6 months, there were only Czech Jewish prisoners in the camp. In the summer of 1942, German and Austrian Jews began to be deported. But again, the first 6 months, it's only Czech Jewish prisoners, and they have pretty much a normal age distribution. Germany, the threat had been clear since 1933. So most Jewish families try to help the younger members of their family get out. So a lot of, like, the German Jewish population was just on average much older by this point. Among the Austrian Jews, something similar takes place, but also the Jewish homes for the elderly were pretty much, all those residents were sent from Vienna to Theresienstadt. So the German and Austrian prisoners were on average much older. The Czech Jewish prisoners were pretty much just an average distribution of age, because they thought, until 1938, they thought they were going to fight the Nazis. So they didn't flee the way that the Austrian and German Jews did, who already knew, for them there was no possibility of resistance anymore. So the first couple transports that arrived in November and December 1941 were of young men who were supposed to kind of clean up the ghetto and prepare it for thousands of people to be sent there. So during the day, they were working in the ghetto. In the evening, they were locked in one of these big barracks buildings, left behind from the days when this was a military base. And, what do you do when you have a bunch of people locked up with no other entertainment in the evening? I mean, theater is the one thing that you can do with nothing except body and voice. I mean, it's the easiest art form to engage in. But the other thing that's really important is Czech Jews were extremely assimilated. They have the highest intermarriage rate in Europe at the time. And one thing about Czech culture is they have a really strong theatrical tradition, including a strong amateur theatrical tradition. So you've got a bunch of young men locked up in the evening with no other entertainment. A lot of them have done either professional or amateur theater, so they start putting on shows for each other. And there's actually a souvenir program that survives from a show in December 1941. And it was just a really simple variety show. There's a magician, there's somebody reading poetry. These early prisoners were able to smuggle in a few musical instruments, so there are some musical interludes. But from these really simple beginnings, the Jewish Council of Elders found out this was going on and thought, we don't want people to get in trouble for this. So they asked the Nazi commandant for permission for these simple shows. And the Nazi commandant granted permission. They actually didn't have anything against it. And probably for the same reasons you talk about in Westerbork, that as long as it wasn't something that was encouraging the prisoners to stage an uprising, they didn't have a reason to shut it down. So from those really, really humble beginnings, the cultural life just gathered momentum until, by the summer of 1944, shows were happening in over 18 formally recognized spaces, and even more, more. Again, extremely simple performances were happening in the barracks and other of the prisoners' living and working spaces.
So how did performing captivity, performing escape come to be when you have all of this material to draw from? How did it happen?
To this day, I am mystified why these scripts did not come to light earlier, because things like the children's opera Brundibar, that came to light early on. The Emperor of Atlantis. Some of these kind of musical theatrical works were already well known, but even in the 1960s, one of the survivors who wrote an essay about theater in the ghetto said, "Oh, unfortunately, all the theatrical scripts were lost." And I thought, well, how can that be? So when I went to the Czech Republic to do the interviews with survivors for my PhD thesis, I also asked people, "Hey, do you have any texts from the ghetto?" Thinking, oh, maybe a few things will turn up. 12 things turned up.
Wow.
And they were mostly things that were still in private hands. For example, Zdeněk Prukash, his family changed their name after the war. Before the war, they were Porges. But since that's such a clearly Jewish name in Central Europe, after the war, they changed it to Prokash. To make an extremely long story short, I had the good fortune of getting to know him. His father and mother had a cabaret in the ghetto, and he just said to me, "Would you like to see the scripts?" And I said, "Of course." And this
Sure,
just
give me.
absolutely, yes, and this absolutely fabulous cabaret script, plus several other shorter scripts came to light. And in fact, Leo Strauss is one of the names that is fairly well known as far as, somebody who had a cabaret, a German language cabaret in the ghetto. He actually had some works by Leo Strauss that had never come to light before because his father and Leo Strauss were friends. And his
Wow.
father was bilingual. He performed in Leo Strauss's cabaret, but he also had his own Czech language cabaret. So Zdeněk was kind enough to let me photograph his entire collection, and two of those works are now in the book. So this pattern kind of repeated itself over and over again. And then, just through sheer good luck, a friend of mine, Dalibor Dobiash, shout out, hello, Dalibor, had a connection at an organization called the Austrian Fund for the Future. And they were looking for applications for funding to support cultural projects. So he asked me, "Do you have anything that you would kind of like to work on?" And I said, "I just happen to have several scripts written in the Theresienstadt ghetto." So they provided funding for me to do some further travel. I actually went to Israel and found some additional scripts in Beit Terezin, the archive in honor of Theresienstadt in Israel, and then held additional interviews both with people in the Czech Republic and survivors in Israel, mainly to ask them the meaning of the jokes. Because the thing that became apparent immediately was that almost all of these scripts were comedies. Of the ones published in the book, 10 of the 12 were comedies. And that's not because I only chose the comedies. The scripts I have that are not published yet are also comedies. It's because, as the survivor said, what we needed was a way to manage what was happening to us. So we converted our experiences into comedy as a social way to manage what was happening to us. Oh, and I do want to say one more thing about that original
Go for
Czech
it.
and German language edition. We were so fortunate. I mean, through Dalibor, I was put in touch with Philip Thomas at Acropolis Press in Prague, and he was willing to publish a mirror edition so that we were able to translate all the Czech plays into German and all the German language plays into German to make them equally accessible to both, our Austrian hosts, to anybody in Germany who was interested, and then to our Czech readership as well. And Dalibor Dobiash, again, a shout out for doing those translations from the German to the Czech, and also to Michal Hügerbauer for the Czech to German translations. And
Wow.
also many thanks, because the English edition came about because Professor Carol Martin at NYU was at a conference where I was talking about these plays. So she invited me to publish it in English in her series called In Performance. And a
Wow.
shout out to the publishers in Calcutta who put together that book, Naveen Kishore and Bishan Zamadar, who, to my everlasting gratitude, agreed to publish this book in color because it also features many artworks that the prisoners made in the ghetto. And these works of art are just absolutely stunning. So again, just really grateful that that edition could be published in the way that it was.
And have you got any other books coming up?
Funny you should ask. I am working on a book right now based on those interviews that I did for my PhD dissertation. One of the things that I encountered during all my time working on this material, and I have been working on it since 1998, is the testimony is so positive that people tend to be skeptical about it, especially when I'm talking about testimony by fairly elderly survivors. So what I did for my PhD dissertation is I went all the way back to the beginning. I went back to testimony from the 1940s and looked at that testimony and then another collection from the 1960s. And it's absolutely consistent. I mean, the survivors always, they've always remembered this theatrical life, the theatrical works of the ghetto, they always remember them very positively and with great enthusiasm. But I wrote so much about the 1940s and 1960s that I didn't have enough pages to get to my own interviews. So now I am writing a book which incorporates those early chapters, but then also looks forward to the 1990s interviews, which were conducted at the Jewish Museum in Prague, and then my own, which happened from 2004 to 2008. And again, the testimony is just astonishingly consistent. This is something that the survivors remember as a spot of hope and positive emotion in their existence in the ghetto from the 1940s right through to my interviews when they were in their 80s.
And do you have a publication date yet? So
I
we can
don't.
pre-book you, or okay,
No,
well,
no. It'll be a few more years at least, but watch this space.
Amazing. Congrats on that. We're so excited.
Ah, thank you.
So are there any plays or cabarets that you particularly recommend, and why?
They're all absolutely stunning in their own way. Like some of them are still fairly easily stageable, others are not. Sometimes because the comedy especially is so connected to what was happening in the ghetto on a daily basis that it takes a lot of footnotes. Like in the book, there are hundreds of footnotes explaining what the references are. But they're of all different types. There's a verse drama based on the myth of Orpheus. There's a historical drama, which I'll talk a little bit more about in a moment. There's a cabaret performed as if they're all back in Prague after the war. This is one of Zdeněk Prokesh's father's cabarets. They're imagining it's sometime in the 1950s, and they're standing on Wenceslas Square in the very heart of Prague and talking about, hey, do you remember, for example, Carl Behrmann from Terezin? He's singing in the National Theatre tonight. Let's go see him. So this amazing example of wish fulfillment about what their lives after the war might be like. There's a Purim spiel that ends with an operetta. There's a radio show that takes place before the war. They're kind of reimagining themselves back in Prague in 1937, even though a lot of the pieces in that radio show are actually about their present day life in the ghetto. But I'll talk about the one which is probably the easiest to stage. That's called The Smoke of Home. And it's set in the 30 Years' War, which is a really important historical event for Czechs because it's the war when they lost their independence. It's the war when the Habsburg Empire put down a rebellion of the Czech nobles and then re-Germanized that culture. So based on, from the historical viewpoint of the 1800s and the 1900s, when Czechs were trying to kind of revive what they saw as their natural culture. I mean, this is something that happened all over Europe in that period, these kind of national movements. So it's fairly natural that they would set this play in the 30 Years' War. But in brief, it's four prisoners in a tower who are dreaming of their life after the war, all the things they're going to go back to. And what they find out at the very end of the play is there's been a battle that has destroyed the area where they're all from. They're going to go back there and there will be nothing left. And I had the amazing good fortune to talk to a few people who remember the young men who wrote this play. One of them survived, one of them died, the two co-authors of this play. And they said, you know what this means? We listen to the to our elders. We listen to the older prisoners talking constantly about, oh yeah, after the war, I'm going to move back into my house and I'm going to take up my business again. And we all thought, are they out of their minds? Everything is going to be different after the war. Everything. We're going to have to rebuild everything, which is then exactly what happened. But as an allegorical examination of their own situation, it's both absolutely remarkable. I mean, it's actually a really well-written text, and it's easily understandable as this is an allegory by two young men who really thought through their own situation and thought, no, what everybody is saying is going to happen is not what's going to happen. But one of the interesting things about that script is it was never performed in the ghetto. The survivors I talked to said, we passed it around amongst ourselves, our friends who were also in their 20s, but we just thought, this is too depressing. We
Oh
cannot
God.
stage this publicly. Nobody's going to be able to take it.
Wow. And what's the name again?
It's called The Smoke of Home.
Smoke of Home.
Yeah. And I've
Oh
been
boy.
able to stage it a couple of times. Other colleagues have staged it a few times. There are actually videos of several of these plays. I had the fantastic good fortune to work with a major project funded by the Arts and Humanities Research Council here in the UK called Performing the Jewish Archive. And they have a really good website through the University of Leeds. So if you Google Leeds and Performing the Jewish Archive, the website will come up and you can go to the multimedia link. And you can see recordings of several of these plays, as well as musical performances and other works that were staged as part of that project.
We
Amazing.
will definitely post a link for that in the show notes. We'll do the footwork so the listeners don't have to. And also, it's interesting what you were saying about that project, Performing the Jewish Archive, because I think that was when I first saw some of the performances live in London, and I saw The Smoke of Home, and it immediately hit you as an allegory. And the moment when it sort of gets to the end and they're planning that they're going to leave, and there's been a truce or a ceasefire or something, and they're or it's over, and then the news comes that, like you say, home has been destroyed. So they've spent all this time imprisoned, thinking this is what it's going to be like when we get home, to find out that there's nothing left and it can never be the same. And I remember feeling like I'd been sucker punched, because it was so obviously an allegory, and you could see exactly what the authors were getting at and what they were trying to convey.
No,
No,
I just
there's
have Trem
go
yeah,
on.
tremendous respect and admiration for these two young men. Zdeněk, originally Eckstein, he also changed his name after the war. Zdeněk Eckstein, then Eliáš, and Jiří Stein, who co-wrote this play. And another shout out. I would like to say hello to Zdeněk's daughter, Dorothy, who helped translate the play, and also to his widow, Kate, who have been fantastic, fantastic supporters of all the efforts to bring that play back to the stage.
If I could ask a kind of cheeky asker actor question, you said, like, some of these are stageable. Use the word stageable. What constitutes something for you? What's like stageable? What's not?
Some of the comedies require so much explanation of the jokes that they just aren't. It would be very difficult to make them funny.
Got it.
One of the things I do dream of is having like a site-specific day in Terezin where the whole day would be about like bringing everybody up to speed about the current events of the ghetto and then staging one of these plays with no footnotes. For example, I'll tell you one of my favorite jokes, and this is why it was absolutely necessary for me to talk to the survivors when the scripts came to light. I was there was one woman, Hanna Reinerova, who I interviewed probably 14 times, because I'm a great admirer of Hank Greenspan, who wrote a fantastic book about his own interviews with survivors in the United States. And his strategy is you need to interview people multiple times because things come out the second, the third, the fourth, the fifth, the tenth time that just wouldn't have come out in a single interview. So I interviewed her multiple times, and I took one of the scripts to her when it came to light, and it's from Zdeněk Prokish's Father's Cabaret, and there's a joke in there about they're going to listen to the radio, and one of them says, "Let's listen to that radio Pšerov, or whatever it was called," and the other one says, "Ah, that's not current anymore. That's not interesting." And I thought, "Well, what? That must be a joke. What is it about?" And I showed it to her, and she just started laughing. And she put her head down on the table, and she just kept laughing. The more she tried to explain it to me, the harder she laughed. And finally she said, "Okay, here's the joke. Pšerov is a Czech town that is close to another town called Kroměříž. And Kroměříž sounds like the phrase Kromě Říše, which means outside of the Reich." So it's a joke about listening illegally to the BBC.
Got it. Okay.
Listening to
Wow.
radio from outside of occupied Europe. So, this is how long it took me to explain it to you.
Sure.
To two of you who already know a lot about the Holocaust, imagine stopping a play over and over and over again to try to make these jokes
That
understandable.
would be kind of funny.
I was going to say, I could
I
see that. I think that'd be a really common, like, oh, wait, 1 second. Let me just
It could
explain
be,
this one.
yeah.
Oh,
It could
carry on, I'm not here.
be so cringe, and I think we're approaching a sort of I don't know, phase in comedy where cringe is leaned into. So I think
Maybe now is the time.
I
Maybe
think
now
it
is the time to
is.
try to do this. Because yeah, I've worked on adaptations of some of these plays to try to make it stageable for present day audiences. But yeah, the comedy is always one of the trickiest things. There are also things, our attitudes toward lots of things have changed over time. So, there are certain things that wouldn't seem funny to us that seem funny to them. But yeah, the comedy, the jokes are the trickiest thing.
Off the back of that, I wanted to segue into there's a monologue that what is it's a monologue that's an epilogue in the book.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's the reaches for copy of book. I only have it because I reviewed it. There's not a conflict of interest here at all. New Year's Eve, is it now? How do I pronounce that? Is it? Oh, yeah.
Öderan.
Again?
It's like the Öderan. It's like the German
Oderon.
O with the umlaut. Öderan.
Oderon. So, New Year's Eve in the Oderon slave labor camp.
Yep.
I don't think I've seen this monologue, but I've read it, and was. That there are so many layers to it. So with that in mind, if I read the stage directions, would you read
Oh my God, of course.
it?
I'll just say a few things first. This was not
Please
written
do.
in Theresienstadt. This was, as you said from the title, one of the prisoners who was involved in theater in the ghetto was then deported to Auschwitz, selected for slave labor, and then found herself in this camp, which is a sub-camp of Flossenbürg. And she and her fellow prisoners asked their female guards, "Could we stage a New Year's Eve performance?" And the guards said, "Yes, if we can watch." So imagine this being performed in front of, not only in front of a group of fellow prisoners, but their guards, and the risk that they took doing this. "Dear guests of the holiday camp Öderan, for the new year, we would like to entertain you with the themes of fashion, hairstyle, and figure. But you must be open to all innovations because what we will show you is the absolute latest thing in these areas. Let's start with fashion. The most important change is to eliminate the division between summer and winter fashion. From now on, one wears only summer fashion to glide lightly through life. We don't need to trouble ourselves anymore with bothersome underwear. One wears one's little dress on one's bare body. No brassiere, no panties. Everything is pleasant and cool, especially like now in the winter. So away with mass-produced outfits, heavy English fabrics, double-breasted blazers. Look at yourselves. You look like your grandmothers. The new fashion is young, with openings in strategic places. Our model Edith will now show you a dress to die for.
Edith strides with her hips swaying, turning and making her way across the stage. She wears a completely threadbare dress full of holes, laughter, and applause.
Now for a hairstyle. There's a revolution underway. The shape of one's head and skull are in demand. No more curlers, no permanent wave, no crimping iron. Everything is airy and sexy. So off with that hair. A smooth-shaven, feminine skull is one of the most attractive features of a new woman. Please have courage. It looks exquisitely young and provocative.
Anna strides across the stage, smiling and stroking her smoothly shaven head. All three members of the cabaret do the same.
And now about your figure. Girls, don't take this hard, but the new shape is uber slim. One wears one's bones in view, not with little cushions of fat in the right places. You are all much too fat. So off with that cumbersome fat. Slim and bony is sexy. European scientists have developed a new diet. We will reveal the secret to you. In the morning, black chicory coffee, of course, refusing milk and sugar, and with it one piece of dry bread, by no means more. At midday, a thin soup made with turnips that are actually intended for cattle, but that contribute greatly to weight loss. In the evening, again, black coffee, this time with two pieces of dry bread. Weight loss is guaranteed, and with long-term maintenance of this diet, success is dead certain. The highest acceptable weight is 80 pounds, but you who can bring her weight down to 70 pounds is a queen.
Lisa strides across the stage, wearing a dress full of holes, stroking her bare skull, a walking skeleton. She believes herself to be a queen.
And now we wish you all a healthy and happy new year.
So many thoughts.
Whoa.
And this was dictated to me by Lisa Zeckendorf. She has a cousin in Prague, Peter Broad, who's also been a fantastic supporter of this project. Hello, Peter. And Lisa was coming to town. She was coming to Prague, so he agreed to introduce me. And well, she lives in Israel and she's a psychiatrist. And as a psychiatrist and a survivor, he thought, oh, of course, I'll want to speak with her, which of course I did. He stepped out at one point. We went out to lunch together. He stepped out at one point to take a call. And she started talking about this cabaret. And she started reciting it. And she said, I remember this as if it were yesterday. So she started performing a bit of it for me. And I said, would you send this to me? Would you type this up and send it to me? So she sent it to me by email a few days afterwards, including the stage directions. And that
Whoa.
became the epilogue of the book.
Wow.
And the thing that I really engage with as well about this is, again, coming back to the footnotes. So giving that context, Lisa says when she refers to the European scientists that it had originally been German scientists have developed a new diet and then realized that this would not be a good idea. Bearing in mind the guards, so changed German to European. And then when she says she who can bring her weight down to 70 pounds is a queen, and then the footnote it simply says this was her weight at the time of the performance. So having that historical context, and you and I have chatted previously about it, Lisa, and you've worked with your students, obviously, on the text. And you raised a really interesting question around the notion of body shaming, the context of the monologue and the body shaming. And I am really interested in your thought. I'm also really interested in Alex's thoughts as well, especially from an actor's perspective. So, thoughts.
The last time that I did this monologue for a group of students, I suddenly thought, as I was doing it, I thought, how is this going to land with them? How are they going to understand this? I mean, are they going to see this as an example of body shaming? And on one hand, I thought, well, I hope they would completely understand the context and why this was why this was darkly comic to the prisoners in that situation. And also, as I mentioned before, that the need to manage the crisis that they were facing through comedy, that was one of the ways that they tried to come to terms and to some extent master what was happening to them. But at the same time, there are certain works of literature that we can't really, that are really difficult to engage with today. For example, Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn. I mean, because of the racial dynamics of that work, it's really difficult to work with it today. Is this an example of something that might be difficult to work with today? I have to say, I did not ask the students what they thought about it, but it did occur to me. I mean, Alex, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it would be it I just with the whole culture of Ozempic, we just can't, I can't go through my Instagram or down the street without seeing some sort of weight loss drug, pasted on the subway. And it's so it's disturbing to see. And I mean, I would hope that, seeing, reading this text and seeing this and just the way that perhaps it would shed a light on how, ridiculous it is, and or how just maybe make especially women more aware of how there seems to be a culture of how we're trying to reduce ourselves, try to shrink ourselves, which tends to be, a fad that happens around when a government is being particularly oppressive. So there's this sort of pattern that we see where women are, encouraged to be like, make yourself small, make yourself dainty, it's time to become a trad wife. So perhaps it was like, there would, a parallel would be noticed, a connection of just, think and make them think about how, crazy it is that, there's this tradition happening again, and why aren't we going the other way and trying to take up as much space as possible, eat whatever we want, enjoy our lives, make ourselves strong, and just,
And just enjoy the opportunity we have to live in good health.
So yeah, not sure. I would hesitate to bring this in. I don't know, just talking to students, especially younger students, especially younger girls, or people who identify as female, just asking them, just talking about eating habits or weight loss, I know it can be triggering, so
Can be a fraught, yeah, it can be a really fraught thing. So that's, yeah, that, but other ways that these texts can be tricky in contemporary usage, but also really effective in contemporary usage. When we, a colleague at the University of Louisiana in Baton Rouge, Alan Sykes, and I did a project with his students using a play which is not in the collection because it came to light after it was already in print. But it's a comedy, and it's a comedy about fighting not just fascism, but capitalism. And it's also comic. And Alan's students in the United States were mortified by the comedy. I mean, they just, based on the Holocaust-related education that they had had in the United States, they just found it really, really difficult to engage with the comedy. And we had to do a lot of work with them to kind of get them to acknowledge, okay, this was a coping mechanism for the prisoners. And we're not pretending to be the prisoners. We're stepping into the roles that they played. So very consciously keeping that distance. We're not them, but we're going to engage with their texts and try to understand why they were using this, why they were using comedy. So, after that work, they were able to engage, and they actually created a really touching adaptation. My students in the UK, we worked on that same script. They did not have that same hesitation at all. They had more problems with the fact that this is an anti-capitalist script.
Oh.
And this is, it's really a pro-communist script. I mean, one of the characters is kind of a comic communist rabble-rouser, and they were more dismissive of, oh, communism is just a failed system. So for them, the question was, how do we try to put them in the place of these young Czech Jews who really felt like, capitalism and fascism are intertwined and we must fight both? And, again, it took a couple of weeks. And some reading of the Communist Manifesto and a guest appearance by Karl Marx, but they finally engaged with it and actually began to ask some questions about their own employment situations.
And what was the name of that play?
It's called Comedy About a Trap.
Comedy about a trap.
Yeah.
Noted.
Yes.
And is
Yes.
that going to be, has that been published? Is that going to be published?
It has not been published yet, but videos of both of these adaptations are on the Performing the Jewish Archives website, the
Perfect.
one developed by the students in Louisiana. We performed it in Madison, Wisconsin, for a festival that took place in Madison, Wisconsin. And then the one that was developed in York, we performed here at the University of York. So yeah, the videos are there, the videos of the adaptations are there. And I hope eventually to publish the play with a lot of
Amazing.
footnotes.
So following on from, I guess, kind of bit of a natural segue-ish from working with the students is when it comes to working with the texts in Performing Captivity, Performing Escape, what would you say are the suitable age groups to see it or work with it? And also, reaction, we've already said about reactions from your students. So what would you
Yeah.
say are the suitable age groups?
So all the work that I have done with these plays has been with secondary school students and older, because, I know with Brundibar, for example, sometimes work is done with younger students, but I feel very, very strongly that there's a kind of a danger with the Theresienstadt cultural life that, students might form the impression of, oh, well, the Holocaust wasn't so bad. They were able to engage in this kind of cultural life, that it's really important that they understand the context and not just understand that, this is a World War II Jewish ghetto where they're imprisoned, but to understand what happened when most of these artists left Theresienstadt. And, for younger students, I don't know if it's appropriate to do education about really the horrific things that happened to some extent in Theresienstadt itself, but mainly after they were deported to the other ghettos and camps. So I've never tried to work with students younger than about 14 or 15. And you ask about the reactions of the students. One of the most amazing projects that happened as part of the Performing the Jewish Archive project was trying to recreate one of the works that is represented in the book, but only with the songs. There was a performance called Prinz Bettlägend, and it was kind of an allegorical fairy tale for trying to avoid getting put on the transports. And we didn't have a script. We have a poster, a souvenir poster created in the ghetto that names all the roles. So we knew that they were fairy tale characters, the king, the princess, the drummer, et cetera, et cetera. We had some survivor testimony that kind of briefly described certain moments in the play. And then we had the songs, like all the lyrics of the songs were preserved and they were set to well-known melodies from the 1930s. So we had the songs. And we worked with two different groups. We worked with a group of professional actors in Sydney, Australia. And these were people who were really active in the Sydney alternative theatre scene. So they know how to improvise around a plot outline. So that's what we did. So I did the original kind of skeletal plot outline and then got together with the director, Ian Maxwell, and our producer, our colleague with the project in Australia, Joseph Toltz, and we created a more detailed outline. And then the actors created it from there. And the interesting thing that they hit upon which was due to an accident of casting, but was also absolutely true in the ghetto, is most of the actors were about 60 years old. The actor playing the prince was 30. So they ended up recreating the dynamic at first unintentionally, but then when I saw what they were doing, and I said, no, you are absolutely right about this. This is what happened. The older prisoners tried to protect the younger prisoners. Then, that became the theme of their version of the play. But then what happened when we took this to South Africa? So at the same time that I was working with the team in Australia, I was also in touch with Imelda Brand, who was the director in South Africa. And to make a really, really long story short, she used basically the same outline, but they put their own spin on it. So, not too surprisingly, the play became about race and power. And she was lucky to be able to attract a cast that just, covered every single ethnic group in South Africa, and to assign the roles in a way that allowed for that kind of commentary. So the fabulous thing about some of these scripts is, they're not, the themes that they deal with are not just about life in the ghetto. Some of them are about just more general issues of, with the smoke of home, what happens after a war? Or in the case of Prince Bedlegend, and what's the connection between race, power, and privilege?
Yeah, how could you imagine or see these texts fitting in with the teachings for Holocaust educators?
I've had the great good fortune to work with the Holocaust Educational Trust and to do a workshop for their professional development for teachers. And what we talk about a lot is the ability of these scripts to help the students engage with the prisoners as people, to get past the sense of, we're talking about statistics, we're talking about people unlike us who lived a long, long time ago. And especially when they realize a lot of times these actors were not much older than they are. A lot of the actors were in their late teens or early 20s. So, not just thinking about what are the horrors that happened to these people, but thinking about what were they doing in the last months of their lives. They were struggling to express their political beliefs. They were trying to make each other laugh. But again, I come back to this notion of we don't, whenever I work with these scripts, I absolutely try to make sure we're not going to pretend we are the prisoners. We're going to step into these roles that they created to try to comment on their own experience and try to learn more about them and who they were as people trying to deal with an unprecedented crisis.
And you've talked about the reactions of students and the different ways that the texts have been engaged with. So what you were saying about working with the text in South Africa, working with it in Sydney, what other highlights are there for students in terms of working with the text, or even highlights that for teachers as well, like the real, for want of a better way of putting it, what are the selling points of saying this is why you should work with these texts? No pressure.
Yeah, no pressure. The selling points. The way that it gives you a window into their experience and suddenly makes them into emotional, three-dimensional people. Because one of the key things about Holocaust education is, we can't just learn the statistics, we can't just learn the facts, we have to care about them. Ideally, we have to care enough so that we might take action if we see something similar happening in our own day. So these scripts, again, that they're a window into not just the Holocaust and the experience of the ghetto, but into individual people's experience of the ghetto and their attempts to deal with it by helping each other laugh about it. I mentioned the poster that we have for Prince Bedlegend. There's a huge collection of these posters at the Terezin Memorial. So for many of these plays, we know exactly who was in them. And because there's a database of all the prisoners, all the people who went through Theresienstadt, we know what happened to them. So when a student is cast in a particular role, they can also look up, okay, what happened to this person? Did they survive? Did they perish? But even more importantly, what were they doing in these final months of their lives that they, in most cases, didn't know were the final months of their lives? So I'll just tell you about a couple of moments of realization that we've had in working with the plays. One very common moment is like somebody will look at, because I have the birth and death information about all the actors in the book, and the students will finally, they'll kind of page through that information and somebody will go, oh my God, that's my birthday. Or, oh, that person is the same age as I am now. So they find these points of identification that then connect them emotionally to the scripts in a much more vivid way. Other moments of realization. The first time that Robert Jarman, who played the king in the Australian production, the first time he sang through a song called The King's Speech, Ian, the director, and I just looked at each other in astonishment because the song is long, it's 11 verses. But it's all about how the king knows, all right, I know you are all not content. I know you're all blaming things on me. I know you all want things that I can't possibly provide. But in spite of your criticism, I am doing my best to try to get you through the war. And I encourage you, just endure everything. But the emotional ups and downs of that song and each individual verse are so insightful. And the lyricist who wrote it, I think he was in his late 30s or early 40s, but even though he was a little bit more mature than a lot of the people who were engaged in theater in the ghetto, for him to have that insight into the Jewish leader's position, I just thought was absolutely remarkable. So, and every time I put on one of these scripts, there's a moment where you just suddenly time just collapses and you feel like, wait, I've got an understand. Dave showed me something about life in the ghetto that I would not have understood without this play. And I'll just say one more. There's a beautiful verse drama based on the myth of Orpheus. And it was written by a young man named Georg Kafka, who is a distant relation of Franz Kafka. And he looks at the myth of Orpheus, what happens after Orpheus loses Eurydice, which is a part of the myth that's not as familiar to us. He goes out and lives in the countryside among shepherds, and he eventually decides, I want to welcome the end of my life. I'm going to pick up my harp and play again. Even though I know it's going to attract the Bacchantes, these goddesses who with Dionysus drink wine until they're having these crazed dances, these kind of carnivalesque festivals. I know it's going to drive them mad and they're going to tear me to pieces, but this is the way I want to end my life. And this play by a young man who seems to be saying, okay, I know that my life could end here. How can I come to terms with that? Throughout the play, Orpheus recites different bits of poetry, like I think really beautiful German language poetry. And at the very end of the play, the shepherds who have seen him die start reciting his poetry. And one of the verses is, we gather up his early orphaned verses. And when I was translating it, I thought, oh my God, I'm doing it. I'm picking up his early orphan verses.
Oh,
Oh.
And then, and that play has been staged a few times as well. So being able to have those moments of realization in a play where that playwright has just spoken directly to you with their own hopes and being able to fulfill them, being able to bring their work back to the stage. Not only to restage it, but to restage it for the cause of Holocaust education. It's just an incredible experience and an incredible privilege.
Oh, yeah, that's the power of the written word and theater right there. Yeah, we've talked about this all very thoroughly. Thank you so much for chatting with us about about these works and how they are, yeah, reaching out to us and offering a hand. Any final thoughts, conclusions, things you want to us to leave with?
There is one final thing I'd like to say. I think some of the scholarship about the cultural life of the ghettos and camps, and it was not just Theresienstadt, this is happening in several different ghettos, at times tends to be somewhat critical, as if the cultural life was somehow unintentionally playing into Nazi hands by preventing the prisoners from staging an armed uprising. I mean, first of all, I don't understand why people think the lack of a cultural life would have made an armed uprising more likely. I mean, I'm not sure why that equation even exists. But the other thing is the question, would an armed uprising actually have been better for the prisoners than having a cultural life? Because Terezin is exceptional in this way. It was a ghetto that was not emptied out by the Nazis before the end of the war. There were mass transports in the autumn of 1944 that sent two-thirds of the ghetto's residents to Auschwitz, and the vast majority of them perished. But there were 11,000 people alive in the ghetto at the end of October 1944, and almost all of them survived until the end of the war. So this is one site where the strategy of the Council of Elders, the strategy to just, to try to endure, try to persevere, try to stay alive with the knowledge that the war must end someday soon, where it actually worked. So when we talk about the cultural life, I just always encourage people, like, don't think about this as a strategy that failed. Think about this in terms of what did it mean to them? What were they trying to do? What did theater enable them to do? What did it help them with? Did it help them persevere in a way that for Theresienstadt was effective, where thousands of people did survive? So always trying to look at this from their point of view, from their goals, and in the case of these scripts that we're looking at, as an effective way to engage with what was happening to them.
Yeah, that was a question I was gonna ask when talking about, how can we use this, how can teachers use this in the classroom? Could this be used as an example of Jewish resistance working with this text?
See, there's been so much written about what does resistance mean.
Yeah.
And there's the term spiritual resistance. There's the term Amida by Yehuda Bauer, which is basically arguing, anything that helped to preserve Jewish dignity and or Jewish life is worthy of our admiration. I'm really hesitant to use that word resistance because it's so loaded. Some people view resistance only as armed resistance, and that the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising is the ultimate example of what the prisoners should have done. I'm also ambiguous about the word resistance because if the only value we give these texts is for them to push back against their captors, where is their space to exercise their own wishes? Where's their opportunity to establish their own identity completely separate from the identity of their captors? This is actually something that Frantz Fanon writes about when he writes about racism, that if the actions of the oppressed are only in opposition to their captors, then that becomes its own form of trap. That becomes its own form of prison. So the question that you ask is really complex. If teachers would like to phrase this as an example of Jewish resistance, I personally would rather avoid the word resistance. I would rather say, how are people trying to cope? How are they responding to their imprisonment based on what they know and what they think is going to happen? And then talk to the students about, this is what the prisoners in Theresienstadt know, and this is what they could hardly even imagine. Because we grew up knowing that people can be gassed by the thousands. And regardless of how shocking it still is, we've grown up knowing that. We have to keep in mind they didn't, and for them to even imagine that this could be the case, all their actions, all the actions that they took to try to preserve themselves and to try to persevere and to try to cope, just have to be viewed in that light.
Yeah, lots to think about. To devote a whole episode to like what constitutes resistance. I think like where I come from, I think I just think any kind of expression of joy and pride in the face of adversity is really.
And this is more Yehuda Bauer's take is, yeah, anything that pushes back against dehumanization is a form of resistance. So it's really a question of, how do we define resistance? And is there a form of resistance? And I believe there is. Is there a form of resistance that's really a third way? It's not succumbing to your captors. It's not pushing back against your captors. It's doing something for and with your own community that ideally helps you all cope with this, again, this unprecedented and unimaginable crisis.
Lisa, thank you so much. There are so many wheels turning in my head right now. I'm pretty sure there are for Alex.
Yeah.
We're going to be thinking about this for a long time. We will be talking about it for a long time. If any of our listeners also are thinking about it and want to hear more about your work, want to know more about you, want to know more about Terezin, how can they find you? How can they contact you?
I've got a webpage on the University of York website. So if you look up my name, York, and check, I'll come up immediately.
Beautiful.
No, well, we will post that link in the show notes as well.
Okay.
Thank you again. It's been amazing, and thank you.
It was absolutely my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me. I look forward to talking again.
So that's all from us this week. Thank you again to Lisa, an amazing guest. So many things
Amazing.
to think about. All the sources and resources and things that Lisa was referring to will be in the show notes. For now, take care, be good to each other, be kind.
Drink water, stay hydrated, y'all. Don't waste too much money on skincare products.
Yeah,
Don't be like me.
it's a
Stay
trap.
hydrated. That's my trap. All right. Thanks, Sam.
See you.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.